Protesters are pressuring Iran's leadership with demands for top authorities to quit after the Iranian military admitted it had mistakenly shot down a Ukrainian airliner. The Wednesday plane crash killed all 176 people on board, mostly Iranians and Iranian Canadians. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
The word they are chanting is resignation. Public fury has erupted in Tehran, piling pressure on Iran's leadership after the military admitted mistakenly shooting down a Ukrainian airliner. All 176 on board were killed in Wednesday's missile strike, and many were Iranians. On Sunday, Tehran residents said police had stepped up their presence. But the criticism is not only coming from the public. At least two moderate newspapers on Sunday said those responsible for the tragedy should resign. But the press attacks and public outcry add to challenges already facing Iran's establishment, which in November saw the country's bloodiest unrest since the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Fire officials in Australia say the country's bushfires are increasingly under control as cooler temperatures and light winds stay consistent. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the government is investing heavily in battling the fires and helping people heal.
Now, the response that we're providing today is considerable. There's $76 million being dedicated through the National Bushfire Recovery Fund. That is going to counselling support on the ground, in communities, Medicare rebates to ensure psychological support sessions.
That is Prime Minister Scott Morrison. The Australian bush has been burning for nearly 3 months and the fires have killed 28 people. For more news, go to voanews.com. This is VOA News. Hundreds of people rallied in Hong Kong Sunday in support of the Chinese territory's pro-democracy movement. They say many of their democratic freedoms have been steadily eroding under Chinese President Xi Jinping.
So it is very important to let the Hong Kong people to have the universal suffrage. That's the way we can choose our chief executive, and that's the way to choose the person we want. That's the way to choose the person that is really working for the Hong Kong, but not working for the, working for the China.
A former British colony, Hong Kong was returned to China in 1997. A roadside bomb in southern Afghanistan killed at least two American soldiers on Saturday and injured two others. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack in Kandahar province. Britain's Queen Elizabeth is summoning her son, Prince Charles, and grandsons, Prince William and Prince Harry, to a crisis meeting on Monday. They'll discuss Prince Harry and his wife Meghan's decision to step back as senior royals. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has the story.
Britain's Prince Harry has been summoned by his grandmother, Queen Elizabeth, for a crisis meeting to discuss future arrangements for him and wife Meghan, following the couple's shock announcement last week that they want to step back from royal duties. A Buckingham Palace source told Reuters that Harry's father, Prince Charles, and his brother, Prince William, will also attend the meeting, due to take place on Monday at the Queen's Sandringham estate. Meghan will try to join via telephone from Canada, where she's currently staying with the couple's baby son, Archie. Monday's meeting will be the first time the senior royals have met in person to discuss the concerns raised by Harry and Meghan. The palace source said it remained the Queen's aim to find a resolution to the crisis in days rather than weeks, but it would require complex and thoughtful discussions, and any agreement would take time to be implemented.
That is Reuters' Emer McCarthy reporting. A 190-year-old New York City tavern where scenes from the movie Goodfellas were filmed will stay open thanks to a deal reached by the bar's owner and his landlord. AP's Julie Walker has the story.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
Goodfellas, Tower Heist, and other shows filmed scenes at Nears. The owner had announced that Sunday would be the last call for the pub in Woodhaven, Queens, unless a miracle happened because of rent increases and other expenses. In a last-ditch effort, he called into a radio show with Mayor de Blasio, who stepped in and brokered a deal to keep it open. Nears goes back to 1829. It was the old Blue Pump House and has operated at the same location under several different names. Julie Walker, New York.
And from Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
White cry, I did cry, Honorable Inkler Simile tried, and quite a number of other colleagues, but that fell on deaf ears of the police because, according to some sources, they didn't have the power, the mandate in this particular matter laid with the minister himself.
The Ugandan police seek to charge parliamentarian Theodore Sekikubo with assault and inciting violence Monday,
saying this should be stopped immediately before things really get out of hand. Because when police then are perpetrators of violence against women, this is a more serious issue because these are duty bearers who should be exemplary and held accountable when they go off track.
Malawian groups demand the unconditional release of a women's rights activist as they plan for her bail Monday.
I'm questioning the level of democracy. You cannot say a democracy in a country and you sideline a particular group, region, or a political party. They are not part of the democratic process. That's definitely very unfair.
And the Gambian opposition party plans to embark on a march seeking the return of former President Yahya Jammeh. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Friends and family of Theodore Sekikubo, a Ugandan parliamentarian from the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, will seek to bail him out Monday, according to his lawyer, Medard Segona. Local media reports that the lawmaker was arrested during a fracas between police and herdsmen. Police say the lawmaker will be charged with assault, inciting violence, and malicious damage to property. For reaction to the arrest of the lawmaker, I reached his defense attorney, Medard Segona.
I think we are trumped up charges following a disagreement with the minister responsible for security over movement of cattle. The Honorable Theodore Sekikubo represents a predominantly cattle-rearing constituency where a quarantine was placed or slapped, and in his view, slapped rather unlawfully because there is no problem with respect to the health of the animals. Instead, the problem stems from the area where the minister responsible for security comes from. Unfortunately, for he is able to sell cattle, his neighbors can sell their cattle, but he slammed an embargo on the sale of cattle in another place. And surprisingly, when he's not the minister responsible for animal husbandry. So following that disagreement on the orders of the minister, Honorable Sekikubo was arrested rather brutally and continues to be detained in a police station in Masaka.
Now, Honorable Segona, you know this sounds strange because Honorable Sekikubo is a member of the ruling party just like the minister. So what is happening here?
So is the minister. But Honorable Sekikubo has been known to be a critic, internal critic within the NRM ruling party. And he has always objected to those policies that he considers inimical to the good, to the progress of this country. So he has been, he has disagreed with his party on a number of fronts and in a number of respects. So yes, this doesn't surprise anyone who has been following Honorable Sekikubo and his criticisms of the misdeeds and maladministration of the NRM.
The police are saying this is not his first time of arrest and that there has been or there exists a prior arrest warrant for him, and this they would add to the charges they plan to file against him on Monday. Your reaction to that?
Well, he was not shown an arrest warrant. We haven't seen one either. He's been denied to a number of colleagues, including lawyers, and so that confirms that it's politically motivated. Secondly, yes, a warrant of arrest is obtained in ex parte proceedings where he was not represented, where he was not heard. So it is a question of what the police placed before the court to secure that warrant, if it exists anyway. But we haven't seen one, and the due process of arresting an individual was not followed by the police. It was simply bundled up and brutally arrested. I hope it was an arrest, because the moment the process is not followed, then it's a kidnap.
What do you plan on doing Monday once charges are filed against him, and do you plan on getting him on bail?
Well, we have not been instructed to secure bail for now, but certainly we shall be in court on Monday and we shall determine our next move. And certainly, let me say that strategies are never discussed.
Some of his supporters are expressing concern that his arrest and possible subsequent charges could hinder him or prevent him from going back to his duty as a member of parliament, a city member of parliament. What is your assessment on that?
Yes, that could be one of the motivations for the state to come to this action, but I cannot speak with certainty. And I can also give assurance that it will not happen. We will have him back on duty. Whichever way we do it, we shall definitely get him back on duty. And he's not alone, but it's just one part of the wave of arrests to suppress dissent. He's just one of those that have been arrested and those that are about to be arrested.
I understand his colleague, Buyaga West Member of Parliament, Barnabas Tinkasimiri, tried to secure a bail, but that failed. Does that mean he will be detained until Monday when they bring him up to file charges against him?
Well, we all tried all of yesterday, to secure a bond. But that was a futile exercise. His wife tried, I did try, Honorable Linka Simile tried, and quite a number of other colleagues. But that fell on deaf ears of the police because, according to some sources, they didn't have the power, the mandate in this particular matter laid with the minister himself.
Is that a case of showing solidarity, even opposition parliamentarians going to his aid to try to seek bail?
Well, I don't know whether that is okay. It's a matter of opinion. But I can say that everything is running upside down. That's all I can say.
Medard Segona is a defense attorney for Ugandan parliamentarian Theodore Sekikubo. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Malawian Opposition United Transformation Movement, or UTM, and the Gender Coordination Network at Women's Rights NGO are demanding the unconditional release of Jessie Kabuila. Kabuila, a women's rights activist and a former legislator, was arrested Saturday. This after the police accused her of inciting violence and intimidating judges who will soon rule over the challenge of the outcome of the last presidential poll. But NGO and the opposition party say her arrest is politically motivated. Barbara Banda, chairperson for the Gender Coordination Network, tells me her group will seek the former legislator's bail on Monday.
Well, as the women's rights movement, we are saddened by this development because the cause that we petitioned the IGC for was a cause of rape against women by police. And it's a very serious issue amongst us as the women rights movement. And we see that there are a lot of delays around this case in getting justice for these women. And this is the whole reason why we went for the march, to put pressure on the police to really do something that is visible and tangible. And then at the end of the day, we have one of the activists arrested because she's inciting violence.
Now, I understand her party is calling for her immediate and unconditional release. Is that your stance as well?
Absolutely. While this matter is being politicized because of political connotations in some of the statements, yes, for us, we are saying the war march was about these women who were raped, and that is what should really be seen to be the issue at hand.
But I understand she was threatening public officials, including the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission, Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, and that is why the police expressed concern about it and detained her. You can't just go about threatening people.
That is the political side of things. But you see, when you give a politician the podium, they use it to the best of their intent. And then she commented on that side of things.
Now, are you going to be part of the political party, the UTM stance, that is going to attempt Monday to bail her out?
From a women's rights perspective, yes. Not taking any political party side. But we stand with Jessie because she is a gender activist, first and foremost, and then she went into politics as part of her career path.
Some people are expressing concern that her freedom of speech is being violated as guaranteed in the Constitution. How do you respond to that?
It is a very serious issue for us, because we are saying if we do not have the space for us to address issues freely, and especially when it comes to holding the authorities accountable, this is going into uncharted waters. And we are saying this should be stopped immediately before things really get out of hand. Because when police then are perpetrators of violence against women, this is a more serious issue, because these are duty bearers who should be exemplary and held accountable when they go off track.
Barbara Banda is the chairperson for the Gender Coordination Network, a Malawian NGO. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Sifiso Ndlovu, the chief executive officer of the Zimbabwean Teachers Association, says the recent salary increase announced by the government for public sector workers is unacceptable and laughable. He however says representatives of the workers will continue to engage the administration to find a solution to increase their salaries. His remarks come after the workers rejected a 97% salary increment, saying the offer fell far too short of their demands. And Lovu tells me members of the teachers' union are unable to go to work because they don't have money for public transportation due to what he says have been a sharp rise in food and services, as well as inflation.
The increase of the salary has fallen far short of the expectation. Our own analysis and study has shown that the amount so proposed will only go on as much as giving the teacher only 10% of what he expects to spend, and yet it will leave that person at 90% deficit. Here, in that kind of a situation, you won't be able to even make ends meet. Well, that money is only enough to last only for about a few transactions in a week, and that is all we have. And the rest of the time, we'll be forced once more to borrow, beg, and subsidize the state. So that rejection is informed by the economic realities that are on the ground. As I speak to you, our estimation is that we expect, if all things are normal, anything upward to 11,000 would have been ideal as a salary, or something closer to that. But alas, what we have received is really an insult.
What are you going to do about this following your rejection?
Well, at the moment, our members have been saying to us they don't even have enough money to take themselves back to their workstations, particularly those who are in the outlying areas, far from the cities. They have to get into a bus, and the bus has had several rises in terms of the bus fares, and they don't have that kind of money to go back to work. So we are seeing a situation where a lot of our educators are highly incapacitated in terms of their resources. Well, look, they only earned the subdued salaries in December, around 20, and that money was only enough to last a week. And by now, they're unable even to fend for their own families in terms of their subsistence. And that's a very serious dilemma.
So how can this stalemate be resolved to allow public sector workers to accept a proposal from the government?
Well, the current situation is that, yes, we will continue to engage, but at the present moment, we don't know what government should do. Our advice earlier on was that they should intercede before schools open by making sure that the money accounts for the educators. That would assist them to get to work.
Does the group think that perhaps embarking on a nationwide strike could force the government to rethink the proposal it gave to you? Because there's an understanding that over a 90% increase, significant, that others are not getting.
But then when you come to realize what it translates into, is just about $2,000. And when you look at the cost of living, which is skyrocketed to beyond $10,000 a month, and that is what we are experiencing in reality. So unless there is a way of containing the rise in basic commodities and also the rise in the basic services in the country, it will make life very difficult for any worker for that matter, but only for educators. So what we are saying is to say, let us create a situation where we can bring about something that can impact meaningfully in their lives. And you talk of a strike. We haven't pronounced any strike at all. We are not yet in a concrete situation. What we are saying to them is we are in an incapacitated situation. So let us capacitate the educators, allow them to go to work. They are willing to deliver. They are willing to get to work, but they have no means of getting there.
The government is saying there's no money, it is broke, it doesn't have sufficient funds to meet other demanding areas and sectors of the economy. So how do you resolve the stalemate in engaging the government?
We should be engaging, definitely. Last year, for example, we ended with the government declaring that it was almost having a budget surplus, and that is a very positive way. But when we look at the surplus, which is created at the bench for a deficit salary award for employees, then you are having the employees subsidizing the state. In other words, the employees are the ones paying for the surplus that we are seeing. So that is not a sustainable and an economically justifiable position. And that argument is very strong, because when we're looking at the issues of economic equity, we are left poorer as workers, but we are not working. So we would rather have a situation where we have a better improvement. Yes, let us work on the improvement of deficits and reducing the deficits from 9 to something that is manageable.
Sifiso Ndlovu is the Chief Executive Officer of the Zimbabwean Teachers Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. The Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC Party, seeks to embark on a peaceful march to demand the return from exile former President Yahya Jammeh, according to Dudu Ja, the deputy spokesperson and secretary of the party. Meanwhile, some Gambians have petitioned the authorities to refuse the march, saying it will be insensitive to the victims who suffered under the former president's rule. Dudu Ja, the deputy spokesperson of the opposition APRC, tells me there's need for the international community to keep its part of the agreement, which will ensure former President Yahya Jammeh returns to the Gambia.
It's a peaceful demonstration or a peaceful march. And we're not saying that they have to intervene or to allow the former president to come home. We're calling for them to respect the joint declaration, and they must make sure that it is implemented. It is not like we're begging for mercy or pleading. This was an agreement that definitely made him to leave this country and go into exile to allow peace to reign, especially when a new government ushers in, talking about democracy, rule of law, accountability, good governance. I think you should be exemplary in all angles. But you cannot make agreements, then you ignore it. What happens in future, we're not praying for it, but if it occurs in another country and they want to intervene, would those people take them to be credible? Because there's an agreement that you negotiated for and you want to ignore and put under the carpet. To me, that is not democratic. And per our constitution, there are rights given to ex-presidents, and one of which is they have to be resident in the country. Bonus and allowances, security should be provided for them.
So what has been the reaction from the government after you made this plan known about your peaceful march?
Yes, it's like we have shaken them, especially the government spokesperson, Ibrahima Sankare, who we've known that during the days of the former president, he was in exile for over 20 years in the U.S. His dislike or hatred, I would say, for the former president, it's no secret. It is in the open. Anytime he speaks, you will see the vengeance in him and the dislike for the former president. Now, for them to pronounce that this government cannot provide or guarantee safety or security for the former president. Definitely it's telling the whole world that this country is not secure. The security status of this country is fragile, which we will still point fingers to this current government. What are they doing? What have they offered to their own people in terms of security? If you're still saying you can secure a former head of state in this country, definitely there is no hope, there is no future for this current government. As far as security is concerned, people are hopeless.
But yeah, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is holding a process to reconcile the country, investigating atrocities allegedly committed during President Jammeh's regime. Isn't this going to bring more rancor, more disturbances, and remind people of the troubles and problems they encountered during President Jammeh's regime?
Thank you very much. That's a very good question. And many people, that's their perception. But let me say this. The Gambia is not the first country to have a truth and reconciliation. Take countries like South Africa, countries where genocide has happened in Africa. What did they do? Did they send the leaders or people involved into exile before they could hold truth and reconciliation? I don't believe that should be the case. How can a single individual hold a country ransom, whom you know that he is an ex-president, but he cannot be allowed in the country? If he's back, nothing is going to function as far as truth and reconciliation is concerned. That is definitely laughable. In the history of Africa and the world or third world countries, I never heard that people who are in charge or who commit atrocities must go into exile before people can look into the past or dig into issues. That is definitely laughable.
Some people, I understand, have petitioned the government not to allow you to even go on this peaceful march. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, that's the victim center. They said they put a petition. How many victims? They should give us a number. They just said the victims. How many? Could be 5, could be 10. Now, do you hold a political party, whom you know that is one of the biggest political parties in this country, that they cannot process? As we speak to you right now, there's a peaceful march going on. People who support the president that he should go for 5 years. Are we foreigners? We're also citizens, and we have rights. We know what the law says. Everybody can go out there and make a peaceful protest, but the APRD as a party, we must be kept in a hole, and they have to cover us. We have no rights to do anything until they look into what happened with the former president. The former president is a former president. He is in exile. We are citizens of this country, and we have rights per the constitution and being citizens of this country. We did not say we are going out to create trouble. We said a peaceful demonstration, a peaceful march. We also believe it is our right as Gambians, and they cannot say victims say this to hold us to ransom. How many victims? That is the question. Let them tell us.
So what is your next line of action, looking at the strong opposition you are getting from your plan to go on a peaceful march?
As far as we are concerned, we've applied for a permit through all the light tenders. We are following protocols. We know what the law says, and we're not going to break the law. We have taken every route possible legally to make sure our rights are also given. But in the circumstance they want to deny us our rights illegally or unlawfully, we will also exercise our rights to the fullest. And we have decided, we applied, if they give us a permit, we'll go ahead and hold our protest. If they deny us the permit, we will still go out and make a peaceful demonstration, because the other organization groups that they are giving permits, they are no better than us. They're citizens who are citizens. They're entitled to rights, so do we. You cannot pick and choose what you like. That's why I'm questioning the level of democracy. You cannot say a democracy in a country and you sideline a particular group, region, or a political party. They are not part of the democratic process. That's definitely very unfair.
Dudu Jah is the deputy spokesperson for the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, a legal advisor to the Libyan's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, says there's need for the international community to do more to help the North African country to restore peace and stability. Eldin Abdelkrim Al-Shokri says Libya's problems could be traced to insecurity, which he says, if addressed, will ensure the country's peace and, by extension, the entire North African region. His comments come after armed groups observed a ceasefire beginning Sunday. To learn more about the ceasefire, I reach Eldin Abdelkrim Al-Shokri.
You know, what we see in this ceasefire, what we are asking as Libyans, since the beginning, the role of the democratic free nation of the United States of America to play a good role in disarming the terrorist organizations and withholding their leaders, terrorist leaders, to their actions and putting them on trials or getting rid of them, the way that we got rid of this terrorist leader, Soleimani.
What is next after following this ceasefire? What's next?
What we hope is dismantling those terrorist organizations and disarming them. That doesn't happen, the war against terrorists will continue, for sure.
But how do you plan on disarming them? How does General Haftar plan in disarming these people you describe as terrorists, who they said are freedom fighters?
Freedom fighters for what? You know, for having the mullahs in Tripoli, the Iranian mullahs, or having the Sadr Gariani, who is, a sheikh of terrorists in Libya? They are not. They can't be freedom fighters. Well, the Libyan people, in the beginning of the February Revolution, they were looking at them as freedom fighters. They thought, but the fact is, they have taken off that facade of democracy and became terrorists with all their slogans, tried to impose Islamic Sharia on the Libyan people, cutting heads of human beings, cutting their hands, all these things the Libyan people will never allow to happen in Libya. And it happened in Benghazi. When they were in control in Benghazi, 700 Libyans were assassinated.
How does this ceasefire lead to a restoration of peace and stability in Libya and to prevent what most people are describing as instability that could affect the entire Middle East and North Africa?
You see, there will be no solution because the Libyan problem is not a political. It is a security problem. As long as there are terrorist organizations having arms, controlling part of the country or part of the capital, then we have a big problem, not only the Libyans, the region in general, and the Mediterranean, and probably the world. And when you see fanatics ISIS terrorists being transferred from Syria, from Idlib, and from Iraq through Turkey to Misrata and to Tripoli, then the international community should take notice. And this is not a war between Libyans. It is a war on one side, the Libyan people and their armed forces, and the Libyan parliament led by Adil Saleh, and the government of Libya led by Abdullah Tanin, and the Libyan armed forces led by Marshal Khalifa bin Qasem Haftar. And the other side is the organizations of terrorists from all over the world.
What can the international community play in helping the people of Libya to restore some form of normalcy?
Until now, what the UN representative in Libya, all of them, since the beginning of this situation in Libya in 2011 till now, they are only managing the conflict. They are not looking for solutions. Now, the Libyan people decided in 2014 to have a solution for their security problems. And now, the world should order this representative of the United Nations to side with the Libyan people. He knows the facts. The problem in Libya never been a political. It is a security problem.
Eldin Abdelkrim al-Shokri is a legal advisor to Libya's National Army led by General Khalifa Haftar. He spoke with me from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas in Puga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and a very good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The fourth round of group matches in this season's African Champions League kicked off on Friday with a 2-0 win for Zamalek of Egypt over Zesco United of Zambia and a goalless draw between JS Kabylie of Algeria and Raja Casablanca of Morocco. In Group A, five-time champions Zamalek of Egypt, that beat Zesco United 2-0 in Cairo, moved closer to the knockout stages. Also three-time champions Raja, whose group campaign began poorly with a 2-0 home loss to holders Esperance of Tunisia, are set for a top-two finish and a spot in the quarterfinals. Esperance and Raja have 7 points each, Kabylie 4, and AS Vita Club of DR Congo 1. In Group B, Egyptian giants Al Ahly drew with FC Platinum in Bulawayo on Saturday. Winless in their three matches, Platinum snatched a point from Ahly, who have won the Champions League 8 times. Tunisia giants Etoile du Sahel got a 2-1 victory over Sudan's Al Hilal in Omdurman. Now Etoile leads Group B with 9 points. Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa beat USM Alger 2-1 in Pretoria on Saturday. The victory took Sundowns to 10 points after 4 matches, and at least a win from their remaining 2 matches will take them to the knockout stage. USM Alger remained third with just 2 points, while Morocco's Wydad Casablanca Athletic are on 5 points. Angola's Pedro de Luanda are one bottom of the group with just a point. Meanwhile, Liverpool forward Sadio Mane was crowned Africa's best football of the year on Tuesday in Cairo. The Senegalese star has helped Liverpool win the Champions League, the FIFA Club World Cup, and the UEFA Super Cup this year, making Liverpool the first English side to hold all three trophies simultaneously. Mane also helped his country to the Africa Cup of Nations final in Egypt. Nigerian Football Federation has shown interest in hosting the 2020 Women's Africa Cup of Nations. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, President Ahmad, is reported to have said that Equatorial Guinea are also interested in hosting the event. CAF is seeking a host for the finals after Congo Brazzaville pulled out of hosting of the 12-team event last year. Defending champions Nigeria have previously hosted and won the Women's Nations Cup in 1998, 2002, and 2006. Six nations have hosted the event since it switched to a tournament format in 1998. Nigeria and South Africa both staged it thrice, Equatorial Guinea twice, while Namibia, Cameroon, and Ghana have staged it once. Nigeria's women are the most successful national team in African football history, with 9 titles, 2 more than Egypt's men's team. And in athletics, a two-time London Marathon winner Wilson Kipsang has been charged for, quote, whereabouts failures and tampering by the Athletics Integrity Unit. The 37-year-old Kenyan is now banned from competing until his hearing has taken place. Kipsang, the London 2012 Marathon bronze medalist, has also won the Berlin, New York, and Tokyo marathons. And according to media reports, his management stressed that he has not failed his drug tests and that no prohibited substances were found. Kipsang is the sixth fastest marathon runner in history, with a personal best of 2 hours, 3 minutes, and 13 seconds. Finally, Russia's appeal against its 4-year ban from all major sporting events has been referred to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. In December 2019, Russia's anti-doping agency was declared non-compliant for manipulating lab data handed over to investigators in January 2019. The final decision in the punishment now rests with the Court of Arbitration for Sport, whose ruling on the matter would be binding. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Perhaps shocked by the marginalization of the United Nations at a time when the international community was at the brink of a wider war in the Middle East, the president of the Security Council for the month of January convened an open minute of the Council to review the Charter of the United Nations. Many member states participated in the three-day meeting, but one wonders whether the many statements that they made could have any impact whatsoever. The reason is that the weakening of the United Nations has been going gradually since the end of the Cold War. We are at a stage when member states really do not believe that the Security Council can play any meaningful role in acute international crisis. Just imagine that we have such a serious crisis in the Middle East in the last few days, and no one believed the convening of the Security Council to tackle the matter will be helpful. This is unprecedented. The reason for this is that certain reforms that have been taken by member states has weakened one key body of the United Nations, the Secretariat and the Secretary General. People forget that under the Charter, the Secretary General is given a very important role under Article 99. But some powerful states have made it clear, particularly after the administration of Dr. Boutros-Ghali, that they do not want a strong Secretary General or a strong Secretariat. So things are just moving, flouting. But what are the consequences for that? The consequences is that many things are being done today outside of the United Nations. The Middle East, which used to be a center of discussion in the Security Council and the General Assembly, is now handled by other people outside of the United Nations. You have a situation where, for example, we are seeing in Libya, even though the Security Council, through its resolution of the no-fly zone, created the problem, today the matter of Libya is handled by other states outside of the United Nations. And after Turkey had intervened, both Turkey and Russia declared ceasefire on the 12th of this month, something which normally should have been done by the United Nations Security Council. It is very rare indeed to see the Secretary General of the United Nations speak eloquently about the threat to peace in the Middle East or other parts of the world. In the past few days, the Secretary General issued an initial statement from Geneva, which was considered not adequate. He returned to New York and issued another statement, but refused to answer any question. This is the situation that we have. Of course, the United Nations continue to perform useful role in humanitarian and human rights issues, but the essence of the organization is the maintenance of international peace and security. And not only the major powers, but many states today, they honor the charter, particularly Article 4, which is against the use of force or the threat of the use of force, more in the breach than in the observance. Then what should be done? We have a situation where people believe that unilateralism is the way out. You have unilateral action, unilateral sanctions, and requirements that the international community obey their unilateral action. We have trade wars outside the WTO. And even now, the WTO, which was acclaimed when it was formed, has come to a screeching halt because one member state has refused to move ahead to deal with the issue of compliance. Now, those who believe in power, economic power, military power, will say to you, be realistic. The world will be ruled by the powerful. I am not so sure. We have had powerful men who have said that their regime will last for 1,000 years. But where are they today? We have had claims that multilateralism is dead, that globalism is dead. I am not so sure. So what members should do, particularly African states, is should begin to work hard to revitalize the General Assembly, an institution that was so vital in the 70s and 80s, because it is not for just having meetings when the big boys decide to make wars that will engulf all mankind. So this is a requirement for age. The maintenance of international peace and security should be our focus. Yes, major powers do not want constraints, but the humanity does not want them to get us all into trouble. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Oliver Ngoma with a Bunny, and then Hawa ends it all with Intarejia Kucheka.
Sunday blue rain. siamini zaidi waniulize mimi wajue nyumba kwa mtaa zinatangaza habari kwa mtandao zinatapaka hawa ni midoro nimepoteza nimekuwa teja hali yangu iliumiza ndugu na jamaa amani kawa sina kwa kuharaba Mola wabariki na naombea mema mana
And that was Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Weng, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a single bracelet does not jingle. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel.